The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, Senior Editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by this week's special guest, who is Lavinia Morris, Head of Planning EMEA at M&C Saatchi Performance. Hello to you, Lavinia.
Hi Matt, happy to be here.
And also joining us this week is my fellow connoisseur of post-event fatigue, John Still, Head of Content at ExchangeWire. Hello to you, John.
Hi Matt, thank you very much for having me. I hope you are doing well after ATS London.
I'm doing very well indeed. Super. Nothing but coffee and tea dragging me through the end of this week. So we'll dive into the first news story of the week, which is that Netflix are contemplating acquiring ad-supported CTV platform Roku, according to a report published by Business Insider. The rumoured purchase could remedy the company's recent issues by providing access to a pre-built ad tech stack, promising a faster implementation of their recently announced ad-supported tier. While some analysts are sceptical that the deal will come to fruition due to Netflix's device-agnostic approach, others point out that the lion's share of Roku's revenue comes from advertising rather than devices, at $646 million compared to $86 million in Q1 2022. Furthermore, Amazon's offering of both a device, i.e. Fire Stick, and streaming platforms such as Prime and IMDb Freevee indicates that adopting hardware wouldn't necessarily damage Netflix's brand. So keen to get your first impressions on this one, guys, and also want to find out how would a Netflix Roku tie-up impact the streaming and CTV markets. John, let's start with you.
I would say that it is a marriage made in heaven, but it's more one of convenience, I think, given the both of the companies' difficulties at the moment. Both Roku and Netflix have seen fairly significant hits from Netflix from subscriber numbers. Roku in their value since 2021 has plummeted about 80%. But I think there's should be mutual interest. It's an interesting move, given that Roku was initially spun off in 2008 from Netflix before they decided not to go down the device route. But it does give Netflix that access to an immediate ad tech stack. It is a quick fix for them when they really need one. Competitors are going to be moving into the sphere at speed, and a Roku purchase, given their success in the ad area, offers the chance for them to get straight in, pre-built, and have an ad tech stack there. From the device side, it's interesting. It's not clear whether that would be part of what Netflix are looking to do, whether they're going to go for proprietary devices. But in terms of the ad stack itself, it is an interesting move.
Lavinia, what are your thoughts on this one?
Oh, I'd be so excited for this to actually happen. I think it would completely change our ad space in a way that we've all been waiting for. You know, like John said, it would be a marriage made in heaven, so to speak. It's something that I think, you know, the UK has been a bit slow on the uptake of CTV compared to the US, which I think is normal considering the TV landscape is completely different of the two markets. And actually, if Netflix did this, I think everybody else would follow in quick succession. And then it will mean that we'll be able to do so much more CTV successfully, which is what we're all so desperate to do in the UK. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting move. I think it's probably not clear exactly what that relationship will look like. You know, it seems to be that it's going to be a merger where it all becomes one, but it might end up just being an acquisition, which is a side business, or I don't know, who knows, but it would be exciting to think that that's going to be one unit together and we can see the evolution of that whole space completely.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. And we'll be hugely interested to see how that combination occurs. On that note, it'd be interesting to get your guys' perspectives on why you think Netflix would be going down that acquisition approach rather than simply going for a partnership. We've seen several commentators on the initial report of this asking that question, especially given the you know, economic troubles we're currently facing. John, what are your views on that?
In the first instance, speed. It's pre-built. It's a huge platform. I think it's the largest used platform in the States for CTV anywhere, Roku. and it is a direct entry for Netflix into, like Lavinia said, and, you know, this is a burgeoning market. There are agencies, advertisers out there who can't wait to get involved with Netflix. It's a huge opportunity for them. And it is, the acquisition is the quickest way for them to get right involved, I think, in that space. I'm not sure if you feel the same on that, Lavinia, but I think speed is the key here.
Yeah, 100%. I also think that it's pretty much what all businesses are doing at the moment. We're seeing a lot of mergers and acquisitions. We're seeing companies being bought in this way just to facilitate further growth. And I think it makes sense why start from scratch when you've got something that's got a really good tech stack behind it and almost sells the dream in terms of what you can do in this space in terms of forecasting and tracking and audience segmentation. So yeah, it seems like an obvious thing to do as opposed to just building it from scratch, which I imagine would be incredibly difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that speed will be even more critical with the kind of concurrent news that Google is finally looking towards opening YouTube up slightly in terms of that inventory. How will that, you know, further affect the CTV market?
I think this is the case for for why Netflix would move so quickly is the speed that their competitors are moving, with YouTube potentially opening up. That's hugely interesting for the CTV space. Disney, you know, we've heard rumblings of Disney and Google partnerships as well. And I think Netflix will be watching, seeing how their market share has been eaten into by their competitors over the last few months, the last year, and will be really interested in doing it as quickly as possible. You know, Roku have their own experience in their purchase of DataXu in the acquisition area, and they've made a lot of headway through that. And I think it's becoming such and more a competitive space. More people involved, more companies opening up. And I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities coming up for advertisers. I think that's one of the main takeaways that's what's opening here is huge, huge advertising opportunities, huge revenue opportunities.
Yeah. I think also, you know, for that to have that loss last quarter must have been a real first time experience, I guess, which they are going to have to pivot to. And, you know, what we are seeing, particularly in the entertainment sector, is that, you know, people are unsubscribing. We had that huge surge during the pandemic where we all had, you know, 9 to 14 different subscriptions. You know, post then economic impact, people are looking to downturn. And I think, yes, YouTube and the way that Google's adapting is interesting, but it's also not necessarily a direct competitor because, you know, it sits in a different sector. It's not considered premium in the sense that you're having to pay subscription rates. And I think this is a really interesting way for Netflix to maintain market share against everything that's coming on the market when people are choosing what to keep and what not. And you know, if you're looking at other brands that add other things into their offering, such as free delivery, if you're looking at another video service, you know, Netflix might be the first one to go. And actually, if this is how they keep you in whilst making an insane amount of money in advertising, because who wouldn't want to advertise through Netflix's audience share globally, then yeah, I see why it makes sense for them.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. I think there must be an element of fear of that in Netflix at the moment. They are seeing that people are really making their choices now between subscription services. People are not keeping hold of all of the competitors and all the choices they have for streaming. It's becoming a much more fragmented marketplace already. And I think, yeah, Netflix will do what they have to regain their foothold and regain this competitive advantage that they held as you know, the leaders in the market for such a long time. And so, yeah, anything to get the head start, I think, is something that they'll be considering.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that feeds back further into the point of why acquire Roku rather than partnering if they know they've got all that data under their own roof when all these walled gardens are springing up in the CTV space. It just makes sense. Awesome. Moving on to our second news story of the week. The threat of a recession sparked by rising inflation and other macroeconomic factors is leading to marketers reevaluating their plans and seeking greater reassurance from their agency partners. This is unsurprising, the report notes, as marketing is often the first area to face cuts in response to hardship, therefore proving that media spend is delivering on ROI is now vital. While some marketers have become fixated on making spend more efficient by restricting their budgets and limiting investment to media partners that offer greater flexibility, others have not cut back but are instead revising their strategies frequently, creating more of an operational burden for their agency partners. Some agency executives speculate that these advertisers are afraid that missing their revenue targets will make them more vulnerable to the fallout of a recession. In both cases, agencies have found themselves spending more time trying to address their clients' anxieties and manage their expectations. So Lavinia, keen to get your thoughts on this one. And how are you guys helping your clients deal with this current uncertainty?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I always think clients always want the most from their agencies. So I don't know if that's necessarily changed, but times are changing. And I think conversations have changed a bit. I definitely agree with the point that, you know, I can tell that there is concern on pretty much every client side regarding what the future holds. I think the volatility that the pandemic brought, surges in performance and then big drop-offs when they didn't expect them, have just made it really difficult. And people had really high forecasts after everything went back to normal. And I think that's what we're chasing at the moment. We do find ourselves looking at really short-term goals in effect to meet the targets that were set a year ago. And actually, the trends don't marry up with what we thought they would be. And so that's one thing that we're having to battle against at the moment. But also, I think going back to that point I just said about how people and behaviours are changing and unsubscription rates and people are being selective about how they do things, it's almost becoming more like, as an agency, we want to talk a bit more about retention and say, like, we know how to acquire customers. You know, we've been doing it for years. That's performance marketing. But actually now the thing that we should probably talk about a lot more is how you keep those customers. How do you actually make your product something they want to maintain? Otherwise, it is a wasted effort. But those are hard conversations to have, because often you've got people whose sole focus is acquisition and they've got a business that's built in there. They've got another team that looks after retention. So it is quite hard to sometimes marry the data and the dots and the strategies in big business units to make that happen. So yeah, I would say that that is kind of the kind of conversations we're trying to have now, but they are difficult. But yeah, definitely off the back of a lot of volatility is why we're here now.
John, what are your initial thoughts on this one?
I think it's a really interesting landscape, and it is going to be tricky. And from your side of things, I can definitely see the retention, Lavinia, and how that's going to be so important. Because brands are, you know, it could be a question of a couple of things. They could be eager to test the water and see what better value they can get in the market. They might also not be keen to stir the pot. They might be happy with what they have. They might not want to go out and try something different, go out on a limb, try a risk. They might be happy to stay where they are. But I feel like it does place a lot of onus on the agencies. It's brands that ultimately hold the purse strings. They are the ones that have the spend and can tell you where to put it. And agencies, I can see in your world, Lavinia, why it would be, yeah, why there's so much to consider at the moment. And the retention is a very, very interesting case. I'm really interested in what you're seeing in terms of new platforms and how brands are kind of, how cautiously they're entering new spaces as well.
It's such an interesting one, because the one point I was going to say was that I've had many clients come to me and say, I want to be innovative. You know, in this time, bring me innovation. And the innovation they don't want to hear is, let's talk about your data framework and how we measure things. And let's talk about your first party data. That to me is innovation, is bringing that to life and bringing value from that. And it's obviously what we do a lot of at MC Saatchi Performance, but a lot of clients just want the shiny idea. They want to be able to have their brand up in lights, doing something different, partnering with something that's never been partnered before, but it doesn't ever really pin back to like an idea often, or an ultimate, business driver, for example. So I think when we're talking about new channels, we're still going back to channels that have always been emerging. You know, for example, connected TV, we're really trying to make that happen, but the UK market is really different from the US. And that's something that, you know, we obviously put on plans, but it's never going to replace Facebook. And I think when we're trying these new channels, we are still also chasing, everyone wants that lowest cost per acquisition. And you're always having to have these conversations where this is a great idea, but it doesn't tick your necessarily hardcore performance KPIs. It does something else for your brand. Maybe you want to look at that differently, but we can't compare all these channels at this, like, together with the same attribution windows, with the same KPIs, because it's just not going to back out. And that's actually how we find these channel tests end up failing, because ultimately it just looks expensive and it's being looked at in the wrong way. So channel diversity is a really big thing, but I think getting everybody to agree to segment these things out and look at them differently is the main challenge in getting these off the ground and into, you know, BAU media plans.
Yeah, it makes sense. And in terms of, you know, getting marketers to look more to that long-term future rather than those very short-term KPIs, is it a case of more, you know, industry standards need to be evolved, or is it more just a kind of collaboration and consultation approach that's needed?
Yeah, I think it's collaboration with the agency and the brand. It's also within the brand as well. You know, like I said, within brands, you have different business units and each of them have different KPIs. Some of them are looking at brand affinity. Some of them are looking at, you know, acquisition. And I think it's also getting those teams to talk with each other, because actually your media plan might really feed into somebody else's objectives. And I think that's something that which we always try and do, is get everybody around one table, because sometimes it makes more sense what you're pitching to one group of people than the other. And actually, if you can all work towards the ultimate goal, which is obviously business growth, then it gets easier to make happen.
Absolutely. And John, in terms of, you know, the report's findings, in terms of how marketing is often the first thing that tends to get impacted in times of economic uncertainty, is that necessarily fair? And what more can be done to convince executives as to the value of marketing, particularly that kind of longer term brand building marketing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair comment. I think people, when they are looking to trim budgets, when they are entering a time of economic uncertainty, people see marketing as a department where they can make their cuts, that, you know, their brand will hold strong while they don't need to push it any further in tricky times. I'm not sure that's fair from someone who has a marketing background. I think that it's, in uncertain times, it's essential to get your name out and to continue, you know, pushing who you are. And, you know, you need to give people who are also in very uncertain times a bit more of an idea of what your brand is doing. I think that to immediately cut the marketing budget is a fairly strong response. But then it's also tricky to convince the spend to spend through hard times and to kind of carry on. We've seen some brands trying to do that, doubling down and, you know, putting a lot more money in during times of closing on a recession and stuff. I think, yeah, it does seem a little unfair. And I think brands, there's a lot more communication to be done in terms of the importance of marketing and the importance of profile in particular.
I agree with you. I mean, my message is always double down. I think it's, you know, that marketing brings in revenue into your business, right? So when you are feeling an economic downturn, to switch off the one of the main things that brings in revenue feels counterintuitive to the problem. And actually, we all know that the second you scale back, it's not easy to scale back up. And you're always then going to have to then double up your awareness activity, start doing, see impacts on your performance metrics when you start. So I do think it's not the right decision, but then I would say that because I work at a media agency.
Yeah, there's absolutely no bias on this panel at all. But yeah, we'll end that one on the bullish notes on come on marketing, and yeah, executives look towards marketing to help you through these times rather than as something that can be cut back. Moving into the third news story, a new survey of 2,500 UK consumers has found that 60% now buy at least some of their groceries online, with 16% ordering most or all of their food and household goods via the internet. The UK Online Grocery Report 2022 from Spryker found that, if provided with a better experience, 80% of respondents would buy more groceries online, and that 28% plan to migrate to online for the majority of their shopping within the next 2 years. With 23% of consumers preferring delivery to in-store pickup, introducing an online shopping and delivery service could be key to lower-cost supermarkets staying competitive, says Spryker CEO Boris Lochtin. As digital shopping continues to grow in popularity, retailers should invest in technology infrastructure that seamlessly links on and offline channels, end quote, to ensure that their physical outlets remain profitable and to win repeat business, he adds. So, John, my first question to you here is, what could this shift in shopping behaviour mean for the evolving retail media space?
It's the only thing that surprised me, I think, initially about these stats is that they weren't higher. 60% did not shock me in terms of how people do their grocery shopping online. I do an awful lot of mine, so I wasn't, you know, not shocked by that statistic. But looking at the survey, I think we've heard a lot about retail media recently. We've just been at our ATS London conference, had a panel on retail media. And it's seen as the next big space, basically. It's, you know, it's a huge area that people are going to be looking into in the next year. It's a massive space for spend. And I think these statistics can only reinforce that for brands. They just show how, you know, how, the way the wind is blowing in terms of retail and how important it's going to be to take advantage of the new platforms, to take advantage of these new spaces. And retail media, it's a burgeoning area that can only grow on the back of this. I think there's, you know, up to 80% buying online is a huge figure. And it's, yeah, it's one that I think people will definitely be looking to take advantage of this year.
And Lavinia, how are you seeing these stats from your side?
I think it's really interesting because I think the most interesting part is these emerging new brands, these emerging new apps, which I know they had really low percentages, but I was quite surprised because I've seen them really rapidly grow in visibility and brand awareness and a lot more people using these smaller ones. And I think I would say we're in the disruptor phase of, like, you know, food, like we were with, you know, taxis, for example, and that shift where actually you're not committed to well-known brands, but people are willing to break out and actually shop through these smaller ones. I was surprised they were so low, but it's early days. I really wouldn't be surprised if you saw some of these these brands expand really quickly and start to become the norm, especially for the younger generations that want quick access food, essentially. And I think the article was saying how these more traditional food retailers skew slightly older, which actually makes sense to me because, you know, they're more organized and, you know, maybe they need help bringing food into the home or whatever it may be. So I think this space is really going to change over the next year or two based on the data that we're seeing now.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there will be some consolidation. I think we've seen, you know, a lot of these challenger food, especially delivery networks there. A lot of them are currently unprofitable. And I think with the economic uncertainty, there are going to be some that do struggle, especially if they're not able to bring those offers and that value proposition to the consumer, especially if they do offer, you know, particularly higher delivery costs. If it's a shop around the corner, people are going to be slightly more willing to go around the corner. John, will that pan out? Will we see further consolidation there, or do you think it will continue to grow as a market?
I think we will see a change as a market. I think we've seen the initial boom and we're now seeing that leveling off, particularly in the smaller rapid delivery stuff. I read this morning that Joker in the States is scaling back its US operation quite fiercely as they find out that the market's leveled off a bit post-pandemic. I think we have the giants in the area, the Just Eats, the Deliveroos, who have the data to make a real go in the advertising space. I think there's some giants lurking in that arena. We've discussed previously on the podcast the potential that lies in that, particularly in the retail media space. It could be a time as the, you know, the bubble's not bursting, but it's getting a bit smaller. We're seeing it drop off a little bit. And it will be interesting to see if there is consolidation in the space, if there are more mergers and acquisitions, or if it is, it stays fragmented and we have, a quite varied choice of market.
Absolutely.
I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, it can consolidate or it will fragment even further. I do think, I mean, party of one in myself, I do find myself using actual restaurant apps more so than some of the one-stop shops, shall we say, where you can choose from, because I just know what I want and actually it means I get it quicker, I can maybe collect it. So you do see a lot more advertising of restaurants or brands pushing out their own app, which have their own offers. And I also wouldn't be surprised to see a small surge there. So as with everything, you'll see things super fragment and then consolidate. And I think that's probably what will end up happening. But I think we will see more brands pushing out their own apps before we see that happen.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Just a really interesting point. And it's quite fun to think that on that side that brands are looking at their own apps and their proprietary stuff rather than just getting involved with one of the major kind of well-known delivery companies at the moment. So I know that's a really interesting point. Well,
they lose money. They have to pay to use these products. And you know, again, everyone's looking on how to save money. You know, you've got a really strong brand. You know, people are delivering your food, but they're having to go through Deliveroo or Just Eat. Like, cut out the middleman, give them a coupon that gives them a small discount on their burger or whatever it may be. And actually, people are probably going to do that because no one's, you know, loyal to those particular aggregators. They just want the food. So watch that space, I say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what other steps can, the kind of more, traditional physical retailers adapt to capitalize on, such a huge market share that is occupying more of a hybrid, I sometimes shop online, but I sometimes shop offline in physical locations. How can they capitalize on that?
I mean, it's the space to get involved in, I suppose. It's having that kind of being able to offer the hybrid service. I think some of the lower price supermarkets who are incredibly popular in a physical retail offering but do not offer online delivery yet, I think that's a space that they'll be forced to move into, as you know, as much as they are incredibly popular and really lovely options in terms of your grocery shopping. They need to move into the delivery space. It's a strong area. It's a growth area, and that will need to happen. In terms of the hybridization, I suppose, again, it's the retail media space. It's making sure that you can push your offers from your offline space on your online space. You can place your brands online and have it available offline. It's it's kind of offering that online offline proposition.
I think if those more lower cost retailers move into the digital space, I think it will really disrupt things though. I think it will put those bigger supermarkets really under some strain, because I think that's where a lot of people will end up going, because it's also become convenient as well. So I think when that happens, and it's a matter of when, not if, I think obviously the infrastructure is going to be really expensive for some of these businesses to build, but I'm sure that's not a concern if they want to look at their long-term revenue. But yeah, once that happens, I think you'll see another shift in the market, and even more competition, even more price slashing, more TV ads. You'll see it will just continue. It's been like that it's always been a competitive space. So I don't think that's going to change.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really good point. I know we've discussed previously on the podcast in terms of, the huge costs these delivery networks are already facing, having these, ghost stores, ghost warehouses to deliver the food. Whereas if you've just got the local corner shop and you can quickly deliver it there, as well as capitalizing on those, physical shoppers, then surely it's a win-win. Awesome. Now moving into the second part of the podcast, where we hear from Lavinia all about what's happening at M&C Saatchi Performance. So yeah, Lavinia, what's going on there?
Well, what isn't going on? I mean, I think it's been, I think I mentioned it before, but we're built on essentially looking at data, and our main objective is a performance marketing agency. And I think what we like to say is that we connect brands to the modern consumer, and the modern consumer is so complicated. They are on so many different devices. Their attention span can fluctuate, and the landscape where it's changing, in the age of data and data deprecation, is really where we are trying to make people understand where we sit in that space and how we kind of navigate through it, essentially. Our heritage started in mobile. I think mobile was data heavy from the start. And so if those are our building blocks, we've now given ourselves a really strong foundation to help navigate that space. And it feels like every year there's another thing coming down to make it even more complicated. So we lost IDFA tracking on mobile on the iOS devices. We had to navigate all of our app campaigns, all of our clients through that. We've now got the cookie-less world coming, which keeps getting pushed back, but it's constantly trying to make sure that our clients feel comfortable. So we're having harder conversations, I would say. Harder, more difficult, more data-centric conversations now. We're really focusing on first-party data, understanding value from that perspective, and how that's going to fuel your marketing campaigns. So I think that's our focus right now, is just navigating through this space, which I think gives us an edge, being an agency, being able to do that. It's really complicated. I think, lots of people were talking about in-housing. Now it's kind of harder to do that because it's so complex. So that's our niche, I think, that we're helping people navigate that whilst also trying to bring in all this new data technology in terms of new channels like connected TV and, giving honest opinion as to whether that's the right place, right time for brands. So, Yeah, that's us in a nutshell, really, at the moment. A lot going on. It doesn't seem to stop.
In terms of, you know, those challenges that brands are facing in terms of navigating identifier deprecation, is there kind of one most common issue, or is it more brand specific in terms of how they're struggling to navigate that?
Well, I think the thing is performance marketing has gotten lazy in some sense, because we had all these amazing pixels and they would do a lot of the heavy lifting. But then obviously there was the role of an agency of how to, you know, maximize that. I think now that that's gone and we're still working with performance led clients, it's almost about how we pivot ourselves, right? How do we pivot to still being able to get results? And I think our conversations before were very much about, optimizing to conversions, but now it's about talking about creative audience segmentation, using your first party data. So it's a little bit further away from those data points, but it's still helping all clients try and figure out what the future looks like. So I don't think anyone is not thinking about this, but obviously if you are really focused on performance metrics, people are concerned. Because for so long we've said it's great, we'll just optimize to all of this and put pixels all over your website and we'll make lookalike audiences and they're all going to work really, really well. And now we're like, oh, that might not actually be the case for too long. Let's talk about how we can still use Google audiences without all of that. And so, yeah, it's everyone's affected. It's just different types of conversations, I would say. Some people are more open to it and some people are scared because it's a big shift in their business to move away from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of those, going back to those emerging channels, such as CTV, which we've already discussed, what's the kind of most exciting one for you, and what are you really looking forward to working with your clients more on?
I think audio. I mean, even like now we're doing a podcast. I mean, this wasn't something that you would even do that long ago. And I think people are much more engaged. It's, you know, in an age where we are fighting for people's visual attention, audio is very engaging. You know, it's, you can't really listen to this and also be doing something else apart from running or sitting on a tube. You're not going to do this and read a book or do this and scroll through your phone. You just can't really do both. So I think this is a really good, audio is a really good way of re-engaging people's attention in a way that we've lost quite significantly. So a really important space for us. And that can be anything from just audio ads to podcasts to anything like that. But I think it's such a growing vertical for us. And the measurement of it is actually improving, or, you know, we're getting more open to techniques of doing that and the audience segments are rising. So this is what I'm excited about. I want to do more of it if people are open to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that audio space is, as John, you moderated the audio panel at ATS London, I'm sure you can testify to the fact that it's just growing massively. And I think just in terms of the technology that's now enabling a lot of it, it's just developing at such pace. It's going to be really exciting to see that going forward.
Oh, no, I'm so glad you've said audio, Lavinia. It's an area I'm really, really interested in. And I did do the panel. I did the panel at ATS London about the future of audio and how it's grown basically in the pandemic, how there was a boom in the audio space. But I think the most interesting thing, like you said, it's like the variety of options with audio. It's, you know, the attention is so high because people are actively listening. They are choosing to listen. And whether it's a host read ad, whether it's a pre-roll, whether it's, you know, a programmatic ad, it's like people are there, people are engaging, people are listening. And then you look at the audio web and home speakers, and people are interacting with their ads during audio through audio speakers and ads. And I'm with you. I think audio is a very exciting area coming up. I think it's, you know, it's been seen as kind of a retro area for a long time because we have such a visually led world. But I am delighted that audio is, it's back.
It's on the list. Yeah, we're fighting its cause over here.
Yeah, good.
Awesome. Well, that's great to hear. I think that probably, you know, brings us a nice conclusion to our audio content on ExchangeWire. But Lavinia, thanks ever so much for joining us. It's been fascinating to hear your insights.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
And John, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for your time. Much appreciated. And thank you very much, Lavinia.
And thank you all ever so much for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.